Hey, welcome to the Chess Experience. On this show, it's all about helping adult improvers. I want to make learning chess easier for you to navigate, and I also want you to have a more fun experience along the way. I'm your host, Daniel Lona, a fellow chess amateur. Let's get to it. This show is sponsored by Chess.com, the world's largest chess community. One of Chess.com's most popular features is called Game Review. This feature weaves together a lot of benefits in one post-game analysis. For example, you can see how accurately you played, whether you made any moves that were deemed brilliant or great, which makes me feel a lot better about my chess when I get one of those. And Game Review also offers a virtual coach that gives insights on every move. It'll also show you alternate lines that would have been better for you to help you understand how you can improve your game. So go on chess.com, play a game, and try out the Game Review. If you listen to this show, you know how often the guests and I encourage getting a coach to improve your chess. But maybe you don't have a coach yet. Maybe it's not in the budget, or you don't have the time right now. Well, my online membership, Chess Improver Monthly, offers a live Q&A group coaching lesson each month from a titled player. You can submit a burning question or even a game to review. And this is just one of the many benefits of joining. There's a link to join the membership in the show notes and on the webpage for this episode. So go to the show notes, then click to join Chess Improver Monthly. Welcome. I have another fantastic episode for you this week. Last week, we had the legendary Bruce Pandolfini, and now I bring you an interview with the incredible Eric Rosen. I'm sure for many of you, he needs no introduction, but I'll describe a little about him just in case there's some of you who are listening who have not yet heard of or aren't familiar with Eric Rosen. In 2015, when he was 21, Eric earned the International Master title. 2 years after that, he launched his Twitch channel, which has now grown to 250,000 followers. And along with a YouTube channel that has 500,000 subscribers, Eric has become one of the most well-known figures in chess throughout the world. Eric has a love for gambit opening lines and traps. He's beat Magnus Carlsen, the world champ, in several online games. And his entertaining videos and streams have helped bring a ton of people into the game. One other comment. Even aside from all of those amazing accomplishments, I think Eric is just a great human being. And it's really nice to see someone who's so kind and positive in our community as a leader, and he's made it a better one with him in it. I hope you really enjoy the interview. In the first half, we dive into a kind of behind-the-scenes look and discussion at how he creates his Twitch and YouTube content. Then, in the second half, Eric answers my favorite improvement questions that I received from my Twitter followers. Hope you enjoy the interview with Eric Rosen. Hi, Eric. How are you today?
Hey, Daniel. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Super excited to have you on the show. You know, I've been a fan of yours for a while, like probably almost everybody listening to this show. And really an honor and very exciting to have a chance to speak with you and even just to maybe get like behind the scenes look in all that you've done and still do. And so I'm really excited to chat with you.
Yeah, likewise. Me too. I'm a big fan of the show too. And I know there are a lot of questions on Twitter, so hopefully we can get through a bunch.
Yes, I've picked the best ones about improving chess, so we'll get to that later. Mm-hmm. Before we dive into all that, I kind of want to know more about what you do, and how it began, and how you what inspires you in this journey right now that you're taking. So obviously, we'll talk about your Twitch channel in just a moment. But before we get into that, I want to just like rewind just maybe a few months before you began your Twitch channel. If you can think back to that time, like what was going on with you in the lead up to that? Like what did your chess life look like and what were you up to?
Sure. So I started streaming regularly on Twitch back in 2017, like around October. And before then, I graduated from Webster University in May. And after graduating, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. like I was coaching chess on the side, and that was kind of my main income source. And I was trying to figure out if I wanted to like get a normal job, like standard 9-to-5 job in kind of the field that I was studying, which is interactive digital media. I was doing like freelance web design work, freelance photography, but I was still very like passionate about chess and coaching, and I had the itch to travel. So I decided that after graduating, I would take somewhat of a gap year just to not enter the traditional workforce. And a couple weeks before graduating, I booked a one-way flight to Europe and spent a few months kind of traveling between playing tournaments and visiting some friends. And I remember when I got back from that trip in August, I was interviewed on the Perpetual Chess podcast. And it was like my first big podcast interview. And there was no mention of Twitch or YouTube or any sort of content creation on that podcast. And I was actually listening back to it a couple of days ago, and it was definitely a pretty surreal throwback because, it was just a different stage in my life before I discovered Twitch and YouTube and the whole field of content creation.
Before you went down the road of Twitch and content creation, and at that time that you're talking about, did you kind of feel like the only options to make chess a career were maybe either coaching or competing?
Yeah, well, definitely not competing, at least at my level, as like a international master. It's very hard to make any sort of stable income solely on competing. But definitely coaching was on my mind, and I was and still am like interested in like entrepreneurship and kind of building kind of a online business. So there is definitely some inkling of turning my passion for chess into some kind of full-time job, apart from competing just on the educational front. And I think around that time, I was watching a lot of Gary Vaynerchuk content. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Huge fan of him.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, so he's like a marketing guru, motivational speaker, and I kind of fell down the rabbit hole probably my last semester of university, just like binging all his like YouTube videos and podcasts. And I think that kind of lit the fire of passion for me to start making my own content on eventually Twitch and YouTube. I think it took a long time to get started because there were a lot of, I think, just insecurities for me and going out of my comfort zone and putting myself on camera in front of the whole internet. But I'm glad that I eventually did.
Yeah, for sure. We all are definitely glad that you went down that road. And when you began with Twitch and content creation, did you start with it being, you know, kind of something maybe just dabble in a little bit on the side, see how it goes? Or were you all in, I'm putting 100% of my time and energy into this right away?
Yeah, it's kind of a mix of both. I mean, I have a pretty obsessive personality where if I get really into something, then it's just what I want to do. And it was definitely driven by passion in the beginning. And it did start as a passion project where I wasn't really concerned with making a full-time. And I mean, it started like very basic, just kind of like setting up OBS, having a webcam and sharing income, like starting on Twitch and YouTube. I just wanted to do it to share my knowledge with the world and share my love for chess, my screen, and just going online and playing games while talking through my moves. And one of my first streams is saved on my YouTube channel. It's like one of my first uploads. And I think at the time of the Twitch stream, there were maybe two or three viewers watching. and I know two of them were me, so it's possible no one was watching at the time. But it was just a way to kind of get into it. And I think a lot of people have to start somewhere. But that video now has, I think, over 500,000 views on YouTube. And it's cringy to look back on to see like how uncomfortable I was. But it's also, I think, very gratifying to look back and kind of see how far the journey has come.
Yeah, well, I think it's really inspiring to hear how far you've come. And like I said, we're all glad that you took on the challenge and kind of tested yourself to go through with it. But I'm curious about the motivation for starting the Twitch channel. Mm-hmm. What did you want to give people in creating the Twitch channel? Was it entertainment, chess education, both? What did you see as like what you would offer people who watched?
Yeah, it was a mix of both. Leading up basically from 2011, 2012 through when I started on Twitch, I was very actively coaching private students between in-person and online. And I really enjoyed just giving private lessons and sharing knowledge with students who just wanted to take their game to the next level. And doing content on Twitch and YouTube was just a way to do this for a bigger audience. And I think it was just driven by passion for the game. And I think it was still a matter of trying to keep things entertaining for the viewers, but also educational. And it's a very difficult balance to strike sometimes on Twitch when you're live and trying to talk through and play a chess game and trying to play decent quality moves without blundering. So there are a lot of things to pay attention to in the beginning, but I just tried to keep it fun and enjoy what I was doing.
Yeah. Well, I'm still trying to figure out how to play decent moves while not streaming.
It's not so easy.
So at what point in your Twitch content creation journey did you realize, okay, this can be my full-time gig. I don't have to consider the regular 9-to-5 anymore. I can make this everything I do.
Yeah, I think it was very gradual. I'm not sure if there was any like clear inflection point. But I do remember there was a point in, I think it was November 2018. I was on another like long international trip. I was actually in London doing some photography gig at the World Championship match between Magnus and Fabiano. And I was still keeping up with like streaming and YouTube. And then during that trip, I had opened up like Reddit on my phone, just like doing the daily habit of scrolling through the front page of Reddit. And one of my videos that I had like posted a few months ago was on the front page of Reddit, like the r/video subreddit. And it was a video of me unknowingly beating Magnus Carlsen in one of these like Lee Chess bullet arenas. And that day there was just a massive influx of new viewers, like probably got maybe 300 or 400,000 new views on that one video. And like big spike in like the ad revenue for the day. And maybe that was one point where I realized, oh, if I keep up the content and have more kind of viral moments, then it could be potentially sustainable. And it was definitely a motivation boost to have something like that. And but it also helped to just have a already like pretty large backlog of content. Like I was posting new videos and doing new streams on a very regular basis. So like once fans kind of discovered me, then they kind of got hooked into the content. And I'm super grateful that it's turned into a full-time career and a sustainable business.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible story. It's inspiring and an amazing accomplishment.
Thank you.
And so kind of fast forwarding 4 years from that point that you referenced, as of today, you have 571,000 YouTube subscribers, 224,000 Twitch followers. And so as everyone listening knows, you're one of the most popular figures in chess right now. And that obviously gives you a huge voice in the chess world, which is great. And I'm glad one of those people is you, Eric. I really am. I mean that genuinely.
Appreciate that.
Yeah. So how do you see your role now in the chess community these days? And maybe what kind of impact do you want to have?
Yeah, it's a tough question. And I mean, just to reiterate, it feels like unreal to have kind of reached this level of influence in the chess world where like if I post a video on some like offbeat gambit, then there's going to be a whole influx of people beginning to play like some new opening. So there's definitely some larger sense of responsibility. But I think at the end of the day, it's just a matter of kind of sticking to my core values of trying to just share my passion with chess, trying to ignite chess or ignite the passion of chess for a new audience, and also be a good role model for especially the younger audience, because I know there's a lot of kids that watch my content that I think can very easily be influenced by the people that they watch online. So just try and provide like a healthy attitude towards the game, trying to promote like growth mindset where you try and focus on the journey rather than the final destination, and having kind of an attitude where you're learning from every single game, especially losses.
That's, yeah, I absolutely love that. That's fantastic. Everything that you just articulated there is really great. And I think the chess world needs a lot more of that. And so I'm happy that you're out there, you know, espousing those values and bringing them to the forefront for a lot of viewers. And kind of going along the lines of what you said of, you know, bringing chess to a new audience and inspiring people to play, there's often this balance, not only in chess content creation, but maybe in lots of types of content, but especially in chess, I feel, this balance between choosing content that entertains people, it's just fun and just enjoyable to watch or listen to, and then content that actually teaches people how to play the game better. I know that, you know, you do both, sometimes maybe just one or the other, sometimes a hybrid, but how do you try to strike that balance? Like, how do you see your content in terms of offering both? Because correct me if I'm wrong, Eric, it sounds like you want to offer both. Is that right?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think, I mean, the entertaining aspect is one way to try and capture the attention of people that may not be interested first, but have the potential to like really get into the game once they discover like the beauty that chess has to offer. And yeah, I think it's like my approach to content has kind of evolved over time, but it's also been refined over time. Where like when I started, my main kind of type of content is just going live, playing chess games, and then talking through my thoughts. And I still do a ton of that today. And yeah, it's a matter of being able to talk through a game, provide some lessons, but also kind of keep things interesting, and also trying to experiment with new types of content once in a while. So part of that has been kind of sharing my love for tricky openings and gambits, and playing in a more aggressive and dubious style compared to what I would normally do in a tournament game. And that's the great thing about online chess, is there's less pressure, and I'm not too attached to my online ratings, so I'm okay taking more risks than usual if it's especially if it's providing more entertainment value for the audience. And yeah, it's a tricky thing to do, and I'm not quite sure if that's like the most, or if it's the easiest question to answer, but
right,
yeah.
Right. Like, well, maybe I can ask it in this way, sure, too, to kind of just dive into the subject more, because it fascinates me, and I hope it fascinates the listeners as well. Going into content, do you say, okay, you know, maybe this isn't entertaining enough, or this isn't educational enough, I need to add maybe a bit more of one or the other? Is it front of mind? At this point, does it kind of come naturally for you to just kind of weave the two together?
Yeah, I think at this point it's become more natural. And I will say, like, I don't do too much like pre-planning with my content. Like, a lot of my YouTube content is just the best moments from Twitch streams, like either best games or like full tournaments. And before a Twitch stream, there's not too much like, okay, here's the exact thing I'm going to show. It's just a matter of going live and playing chess. And that's the amazing thing about chess, is you could play a game and you never know if it's going to be like a really, really spectacular game that will kind of captivate people from, at least in my case, from around the world. So yeah, a lot of my content is just spur of the moment, where you never know what's going to happen. Like the other day I was streaming Title Tuesday, and there were a few games that were just, it's hard to believe they happened in the same tournament. There was one game where, like my only winning sequence was to promote to knight with checkmate. Like, if I promote to queen, I was getting mated. And that was the first time in my life doing that. And then another game, I was getting crushed by Grandmaster Azoria. He had like rook, bishop, and five pawns, but then I tricked him into some funny stalemate trap. So it was, I mean, both of those, I think, were really entertaining, but also like they provide some valuable lessons that sometimes you have to think outside of the box and be really resourceful and resilient.
Yeah, I have a question later for you about stalemate traps. Definitely. So we'll definitely cover that.
Looking forward.
Oh, there was something that we talked about, Eric, before we recorded today in a previous conversation. And I asked you about how you teach to the different rating levels that are part of your audience. Because you mentioned to me that your audience covers a pretty wide spectrum of skill level. And, you know, I was curious how you manage to, you know, effectively teach to everybody who's listening and not have it feel too difficult or too easy for the majority of your audience. And you told me that one of the ways that you felt you could speak to everybody was through the games that you went through and talked through. Can you speak to a little bit about that and how that can be something everyone can learn from?
Yeah, definitely. I think every chess game will have moments that or lessons to take away that are very fundamental that even like brand new players can understand, like basic principles that I will try and kind of incorporate in my my game commentary. But then there's also lessons that, like, when there's especially a wide spectrum of players from beginner to master, like even title players that watch my content, I'll still try and like incorporate new opening ideas or new lines that will maybe capture the interest of higher level players as well. And I think part of playing games and talking through my thoughts is just kind of being authentic and trying to have a steady stream of consciousness where this is what goes through my mind when playing a chess game. And I'll try and draw arrows and make the board colorful to kind of give the visual sense of what goes through my mind. So even if it might go through some or go over people's heads who are new to the game and can't follow everything, I think it's still kind of interesting to see see the perspective. And this is one reason I enjoy watching Hikaru play chess, because when he's like going through a deep calculation and speaking really quickly and drawing tons of arrows, it's hard to follow, but it gives you an appreciation of what the top level of play is like. So I try and emulate that in some way.
Oh, yeah, that's really interesting that you kind of gained some inspiration from Hikaru doing that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I am even far less able to understand what he's talking about than you. But like you said, Eric, I do enjoy listening to him. And now I've gotten to a point where for the most part, I can at least follow a majority of what he's saying. And it really is just so interesting. I think if you love the game, to see how someone at that level thinks through everything. So yeah, just wanted to second that.
Definitely. Yeah. And it's amazing to live in an age where like the top players in the world are just streaming chess online and like being very open with their thoughts. And that was definitely not the case a couple decades ago. So should be happy to live in this age.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like even just like 5 or 6 years ago, that really wasn't too readily available. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, it is really special now. You know, I know there's like, this, I don't want to call it pressure, but maybe incentive is the better word to kind of, you know, create the content that you can tell a lot of followers will gravitate to and appreciate. And I think that's always to be honored. And I try to do that with my own show as well. But sometimes they don't always overlap. Sometimes the thing that you enjoy doing most in terms of content creation doesn't necessarily get the most views or listens in my case. So irrespective of a type of content's popularity, like what's your favorite to create? Like what type of content just gives you the most joy to produce?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really like the variety. I mean, going back to just kind of the spur of the moment games where, I don't necessarily what will happen when I join the title arena, if I'm going to play Magnus and get crushed or play Magnus and win. The other day I went live and I jokingly challenged, Ali Reza Fruja, and he accepted my challenge and we played a 12 game match and he adopted me, but, it was super fun. I was able to win one game, made for a good YouTube clip. So yeah, it's like, I think the idea of just going live and not knowing what's gonna happen on stream or not knowing what crazy game or crazy opening will take place, or there's so many times where I'll just learn something new on stream. Like the other day I was going through the Olympia games. It was just such an amazing event to watch. It's like so many different levels of play and all types of players. And I was filtering through like opening trees and trying to find like the crazy openings that were played. And there was one game that Joe Bava played like some new gambit in the Petrov, which is not quite the Stafford gambit, but it's an alternative to the Stafford gambit, which is still like super dubious, but he won a really nice game with it. So I think there's...
Were you familiar with that line already?
I was vaguely familiar. To go on a bit of a tangent, during the World Championship commentary on chess.com back in December, there were a lot of Petrovs in the match between Magnus and Nepo. So they had a lot of downtime to talk about the Petrov. And there was one point where Fabiano was asked about the Stafford Gambit. And Fabiano was saying, like, it's just such a garbage opening. But then he like, in passing, mentioned this other gambit. It's a pawn d5 on move 3 in the Petrov. And this is what Joe Bava played in his game. And when Fabiano mentioned it, I hadn't looked at it so closely. But after seeing Joe Bava's games, or Joe Bava's game from the Olympiad, and then realizing Joe Bava's played this a lot, it's one way to kind of keep things fresh. And that's one thing I love about chess, is there's always something new to learn.
That's really cool. So basically the spontaneity and unexpectedness of going live and playing games, the surprise and interest of what that can create in terms of content is what you love most, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's probably like my most enjoyable videos and the most viewed videos too. It's probably some overlap are the videos where they were not planned. They just kind of happened spur of the moment. I think the most viewed one on my channel is there was one day, like there were three different occasions where people were falling for the same opening trap. And sometimes it's coincidence, but it's fun to make content out of it.
Yeah. And you never know when you might just spontaneously beat the world champion too, right? And have that go viral.
That's true. Yeah. It's happened a couple of times where I've beaten Magnus in these title arenas, but he's beaten me twice too. So we have a 2-2 score.
Is that something many people can say? So that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. I'm still waiting for the day that I get to play Magnus and then trick him into some stalemate trap. I think that's my dream content goal for now.
Oh, that's so funny. Cause you just anticipated like one of my next questions for you. I was going to ask you, like, what's your dream scenario piece of content? And there it is. That's great. I'm glad you, I was worried that like it might be difficult to come up with an answer, but you already know. So that's perfect. So we can check that one off. We got that question answered. Sweet. Now. Just one final question about your content, and then we will go into chess improvement questions. There's content that can be kind of like your regular go-to formats. And then I think there's content like that's just like a new territory that you haven't been in before. Something new, something creative. Do you prefer one or the other? Do you prefer to stick to the tried and true and know what your followers will love? Or do you enjoy or maybe even prefer trying something new but uncertain but not being sure how it'll be received?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I just prefer the balance. I'm not sure if I have a preference between one or the other. If I do too much experimental content or too much of like my own like usual thing, it could get redundant. So I think the balance between the two is best. And the great thing about chess is there's you can't run out of content ideas. Like it's just there's a potential for infinite content. Especially like I'm trying to dabble more with like in real life content and been playing around with this chess up smart board. Did a collab recently with Lavana Ronian. And last week, or maybe a couple weeks ago, I played just a rapid tournament at the St. Louis Chess Club. And I physically recorded all the games like OTB. So I'm working on turning those into more digestible YouTube videos.
Yeah, I sense that the chess community really loves the in real life content, and I mean, I can just vouch for that myself. I absolutely love that too. I don't know what it is exactly. There's something about maybe it feeling live, even though you're watching it on a video and it may be recorded at that point weeks ago. There's still just something really cool about IRL. So, yeah, I endorse that. Hopefully, other people love it too.
Definitely, yeah, it's great where you can see both players and. I'm experimenting in such a way where I do like the post commentary, like kind of pseudo live commentary after the fact. So it takes more work to actually interpose the diagram and do the editing, but hopefully it turns out good.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Post commentary is great. I don't see that too often. So I think that's a nice angle on it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's dive into chess improvement questions. As you probably know, Eric, most of my show is focused on chess improvement. So I can't let any guest go without talking about that for a while.
Let's do it.
Yeah. So all of these questions that I have for you, the next half dozen or so, are pulled from my Twitter followers. I think these are the best and most interesting ones to ask you. They didn't take it easy either. They asked some tough questions, just to let you know, like some stuff that's tough in terms of like, ooh, how do we answer this or how do we deal with this in chess? Okay, so starting with the first one, and this is from someone who is more advanced too. This guy Paul, he said he was 2000 chess.com rapid, so you know, on the upper end of I would say my audience. Okay. He asks, what leads to better growth as a player, studying endgames or openings?
I remember this question. I did some browsing through the Twitter thread. So I have maybe not the most satisfying answer, but it's kind of my default answer when someone asks like what area of chess they should study. A lot of it is understanding your own style and your own tendencies and also your own weaknesses. And it can vary a lot from player to player. And I guess at 2000 level, it's a level where you have already like very good fundamentals of the game, but also still have like clear areas that you need to work on. And part of being able to answer this question is having the sense of self-awareness and asking yourself and then really analyzing your games and seeing if you're getting in trouble within the first 10, 15 moves of the game? Are you comfortable with your opening repertoire? Or are your games coming down to the end game where you're not converting well, or you don't understand maybe certain theoretical positions? So a lot of it is reflecting on your own play and understanding what exactly you need to work on. I mean, the easiest thing to say is like, both things, you should have a balance in your study routine of working on your opening repertoire and training end games. And both areas are very broad in chess. Like there's like the working on opening theory where you're just memorizing stuff, but then there's also like understanding different structures and understanding kind of the middle games that arise from your openings. And then mm-hmm. when it comes to end games, there's knowing like the very specific theoretical endgame positions that are solved. For example, like the very basic king and queen versus king mate, or like knight and bishop mate, or like the situations where it's king pawn versus king rook, or king queen versus king pawn. So those are all the theoretical endgames. And then there's a whole endgame strategy too, that are endgames that aren't necessarily solved, but have kind of their own principles of trying to target weaknesses, looking to create passed pawns, focusing on king activity. So I don't want to go on too much of a tangent, but hopefully I gave some suitable answer for that.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a fantastic answer. I think that's really helpful. It helps mm-hmm. me too. Just one small follow-up. I think what you're saying applies to levels ratings below even 2000. Definitely. So, I mean, mm-hmm. I like to classify myself as an intermediate player. I'm not sure if that's true, but I like to classify myself as intermediate. So I'm not as advanced as Paul in asking that question at being 2000, but I think everything you said applies to me as well. It more around the 15 to 1600 range.
Yeah, but my goal with the answer was to apply to like a large range of levels where, yeah, self-awareness, I think not only in chess, but any field in life, it's one kind of key factor in being able to improve it at anything you do.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, next question. Have you ever had a rating plateau? And if so, how did you overcome it?
I have. I'm actually kind of plateaued right now. Partly because I haven't been super active in tournament play. So I might have to get back to you in a few years once I overcome it. But I wrote a blog post for US Chess back in 2015. Because there is a period about 4 years from 2011 through 2015 where I plateaued around like 2300 FIDE. And I was really trying to get the IM title, like playing a lot of norm events and invitational tournaments and traveling a lot. And then in the span of maybe 4 months and three tournaments, I gained 100 points, got two IM norms and crossed a 2400 rating and got the IM title. And in that article, I reflected on what it took to kind of overcome the plateau. And part of it was just persistence and focusing more on just improving rather than being attached to my rating and being so concerned with like winning every game. I was really just trying to learn as much as possible and improve as a player. It also helped during that time. I actually had a gap year from college because I spent a couple of years at University of Illinois. I took a gap year and then transferred to Webster University in fall 2015. So I actually had the time to put a lot of effort into chess. And I had a training partner at the time, Victoria Nee, who's WIM, around my level. At least at the time, we were close in rating. And we would train like 5-6 hours a day of like solving like difficult endgame studies and solving tactics and playing out positions. And I think that really helped to have like a consistent study routine where I was putting in the work, and then I was just really sharp for the events that I was playing.
Yeah, that's great answers and ideas for how to handle that. One follow-up on this subject, because I happen to be in the midst of a plateau myself, so it's kind of a question that hits home. I think there's this importance, I say this just to get your take on this, of even while you're kind of struggling through a plateau, of believing that the work that you're doing and having confidence in the work that you're doing will lead to improvement, and that you are improving even if the rating doesn't reflect it yet. Because I think if you don't think anything you're doing is working, I mean, I would just think that would completely sap your motivation. So what I found helpful is just still believing and having faith that, you know, I'm following my coach's advice and still working on the things I should be working, and eventually it'll show up. But your take on that?
Yeah, and one thing I can add to that is the importance of, rather than having rating goals or like a goal of achieving a title like FM, GM, IM, it's, I think, so important to have study goals where like these are achievable things that you can do to actually improve. So instead of like trying to hit 2000 rating by December, you should have a goal of, okay, just spend half hour a day solving difficult tactics, or play a few training games a week and then make an effort to go over them on your own or with a coach. But if you set some like small but achievable study goals that are accomplishable, then I think you'll get the satisfaction of like hitting those goals, and then I think it's just a healthier mindset to like focus on the improvement process rather than being obsessed over like hitting a certain rating.
Yeah, that's perfect. I think that's fantastic advice. Another question on chess struggles. Let's say you're at an OTB tournament, OTB classical tournament. It's not going well. How do you deal with that? You know, let's say you're midway or so, and it's falling below your expectations. How do you manage that and still try to, you know, get the best out of the performance that remains?
Sure. I mean, the first thing to understand is this happens to every player. Like at some point, every player, they're going to have many, many tournaments where it's not going well. And that's part of the game, and that's part of the improving process. I mean, when I was younger, I used to get really upset after losses, and I would cry and like throw tantrums. And I think part of being able to cope with losses is just having the experience under your belt and losing a lot of games. There's a quote I really like is, the master has lost more games than the beginner has ever played. And I think this holds very true to, just chess especially. And I mean, it's important that when you do lose games or you're having a bad event, that you're able to reflect, and rather than just calling yourself an idiot and trying to brush off the games and forget about them, it is important to kind of go back and see exactly what's going wrong. Is it some lack of understanding? Were you not in the best like physical shape? Are you not getting sleep? Sometimes it's external factors that can influence your overall play, your overall like mental form. And then, yeah, just shifting the mindset, like rather than being result oriented, I think just being more improvement oriented and playing every game to learn should be the top priority. And I think in the long run, that will lead to like maximum improvement.
Yeah, I really like that. Playing each game to learn as opposed to, you know, maybe trying to get a specific score by the end of the tournament. That makes a lot more sense. Yeah, I love that. Okay, I'm going to save, well, I'm going to save the kind of the fun question for last. Okay. Let's do this, what I think is the most challenging question of all, but people really reacted to it and loved it. So here we go. This is from a Twitter follower whose username handle is Sir Rooksky. Here's his question. Should adult improvers temper their long-term expectations as to what chess growth is realistically achievable? And if so, how do you balance that with an ambition to achieve significant chess mastery?
Oh, yeah. I saw this question. I was trying to understand it. I think I'm still trying to understand it.
Okay. I think since I am in that, because I've kind of like lived that place and still do agree, maybe I can try to elaborate on what I think he means.
Sure.
I think what he's saying is like a lot of adult improvers feel like two things. One is they love the idea of like maybe getting a title one day, mm-hmm. or even just in my case, it's something even less than that. It's just, I would love to be reach the expert level. That's amazing. I would love to go for that. But I think there's this concern that as adults, you know, like if you only have 1 hour a day, or even if you have two for chess, maybe that isn't the most achievable goal. If your time is limited, your energy is very limited. And so I think his question is like, how do you deal with this reality of maybe limited time and energy as adults trying to get better with this ambition and desire to be, you know, really awesome in chess?
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is a common thing I see from viewers online. They'll touch on this a little bit. Like I get the question a good amount. Like I'm an adult who just learned chess. Like how many years will it take to become a grandmaster? And like you do have to be somewhat realistic with expectations. But I think going back to what I've alluded on with some of the previous questions, the journey is way more important than the final destination. And I know like for maybe some adult players, like there's maybe the feeling that you might have a ceiling and you're trying to reach your ceiling or maximum ability. But I think it's still always possible to keep improving and keep learning new things. Now, of course, it is more challenging when there are life commitments that maybe you don't have as much time in the day compared to like a younger kid who also like is able to learn things at a much faster pace. Their brain is a bit more sponge-like. But I think, I think maybe shifting the perspective and having the ultimate goal be to just enjoy the process. And then I think that will bring you even more satisfaction than trying to hit a rating goal. Of course, rating goals are nice, and achieving like expert or master, that's a cool thing to like brag about or like put in a Twitter bio. But
right.
But I think long term and overall, you'll enjoy the journey more if you don't necessarily worry too much about the end goal. I'm reminded of, there's an interview with Chris Callahan on the Perpetual Chess podcast. He's a like actively chess mod. And he was essentially comparing the culture of like chess improvement to the culture of people playing basketball. Like if you're an avid basketball player, there's no ratings. Like you just play for fun. You play to enjoy the game. And I think that can be a good mindset to embody. Of course, like with chess, there are ratings, and you wanna raise your rating. But sometimes it's okay to just treat it as kind of a leisurely activity where you're playing to exercise your mind and kind of have that competition and also kind of the educational aspect as well.
Yeah, I think that's all great advice, Eric. I really like that. The emphasis just on just learning and, you know, doing what you can to get better along the way without really being too hyper-focused on your exact rating or what rating you'll hit. I really like that a lot. Yeah, I feel like ratings, I feel it's like a double-edged sword because on the one hand, I think it can be a good motivator. You can always kind of strive for the next 100, 1,200, 1,300, 13 to 1,400. So you kind of always have like this nice, clear next step I think that's ahead of you, that ratings can serve. But on the other hand, like you say, you can get so obsessed with it that it becomes counterproductive. So yeah, I think, I don't know if I had, there's a question in that for you, but I'm sorry.
But yeah, I mean, I can add to that a little bit.
Sure, yeah.
If you're like too focused on trying to protect your rating, then you're not going to be taking risks and you're not going to be like leaving your comfort zone. And that's one thing that you have to do to improve as a chess player or improve in any area in life is go outside your comfort zone, experiment with new things. And in short term, it can have like a negative impact. Like if you switch openings to something that you have less experience in, you could end up losing like 50, 100 points, but long term, it's going to teach you so much more about the game and it will have a very good benefit long term.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I do have a follow-up question now based on what you just said. So you said being too concerned with your rating can prevent you from taking risks that'll help you grow. And I think that's a wonderful insight. So the first thing that came to my mind was openings, and you mentioned that. Are there any, like even just one other example you can think of, like a risk that could be helpful, even if it has a short-term negative effect on your rating?
Yeah. I think one thing that comes to mind that I did a lot when I was younger that a lot of kids my age were maybe scared to do is play up a section in a tournament. Like really strive to play players that are better than you. Like when I was rising the ranks of like 14, 1500s, I was seeking to play in like the U1800 section. And I lost a lot of like pretty brutal games, but the lessons I learned were invaluable. And that's, I mean, one thing kind of you can take as a tournament approach is to try and play players better than you, go over the games afterwards. And like every game can turn into kind of its own chess lesson. And yeah, I think it's another case where, yeah, you have to be okay losing a lot to learn.
Right. Excellent advice. Okay. So we'll finish the improvement section with kind of an easier, more lighthearted question. Mm-hmm. One of my followers said that they really found helpful the video lessons that you did with Anna Kramling and Andrea Botez, and found those really helpful and entertaining. And they wanted to know if you plan on doing any other, you know, types of content like that, maybe with those two same people or other well-known streamers or guests where, you know, you're kind of teaching them and the viewers get advice as well from that.
Yeah, I actually did one last week with a very, very much rising streamer, Hannah Sace from Australia.
Oh, yeah.
If you're familiar with her content. If you haven't had her on the show thus far, like she'd be an amazing interview guest because she's improved super rapidly and has been like really invested in the game and studying and streaming a lot.
Oh, nice. I'll add her to the list for sure.
But she reached out and she was looking to improve like her E4 repertoire, and she wanted me to share some of my like opening traps against Caro Kann and Scandinavian and Sicilian. And we had a super fun lesson, like 90 minutes of kind of going through what she plays and what kind of potentially tricky lines she can add to her repertoire. I showed her some maybe dubious traps, but like really fun, interesting opening ideas, and gave her a few like more reputable things to play in any time control as well. So I am looking to post that, the full lesson to my YouTube channel, hopefully within the next week or so.
Oh, that's great. I love it. I think actually, as we were talking about before, Eric, and I'll just throw in my two cents here. I think that type of content is like a great balance, as we were talking about, between being entertaining and educational, because, you know, people love seeing, I think people really like seeing well-known streamers and guests like interact. And at the same time, they get to learn while you teach. So I think it's a perfect blend.
Definitely. And actually, one more thing to add is I was streaming last night and the idea came up from someone in chat that I should get my own lesson from like a strong grandmaster streamer. Like, be cool to get an on-stream lesson with like someone like Naroditsky. Especially, I have a serious tournament coming up later this month. I'm playing this Abu Dhabi like Masters that I really need to work on my own game. So I think it would be cool to kind of get my own instruction and hopefully prepare for that tournament.
Yeah, I think that would be fantastic content. Mm-hmm. I can't speak for everybody because I don't know what they think, but I would love to see content like that. I would watch it instantly for sure. That's some immediate feedback for you on that.
Okay, that's good to know.
Okay, so this isn't really an improvement question, but I wanted to offer this from one of my followers. His name is Simon. Of all of my followers, he's your biggest fan. He's out in Australia, and he talks about you all the time.
Shout out to Simon.
Yeah, yeah. So he asks, is it more fun to win a game or pull off one of your classic stalemate traps?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the stalemate traps, it doesn't get old for me. And there are games where getting the stalemate can be more satisfying than winning. Yeah, that's a tricky one to answer. But I mean, I have a whole compilation on YouTube of like trapping people with these stalemate ideas, Hikaru included, actually. So
Really?
It can bring me a lot of joy.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Okay, so just kind of a different topic, but we did touch on this a little bit as you're talking about still competing in OTB mm-hmm. classical tournaments. I'm aware, and I think a lot of people are aware, that you're not currently trying to get the GM title. So, you know, in the absence of chasing the next title, what inspires you to keep playing at these events? Is it simply a love for the game, or is it something else?
Yeah. So first of all, I'll say that one reason why I'm not so like interested in chasing the GM title is I think it would just put too much pressure on me, mm-hmm. and it could detract from just my love for the game. Like it's so nice to play a tournament and not be concerned with rating or hitting a norm or trying to get a title and just play for the enjoyment of chess. And I played two tournaments this year, one in pretty early on in Gibraltar. It was like January, February. It was this 10 player per team invitational tournament. It was a battle of the sexes. So 10 men and 10 women. And that was a super fun event. Had a lot of fun games. There was a great broadcast. Would love to return to Gibraltar again. And even though I had some really like tough games, there was one game that I had like worked on this new opening to play against Zansaya Abdulmalik. Got a great position. I was winning, and then I blundered like two rooks in the span of four moves. Ended up losing pretty brutally. But even that game, like I enjoyed the process of playing it, and had some other tough games too, but learned a lot. And part of my motivation for still competing is to be able to use chess as a vehicle to travel and visit new places and meet new people. And that was basically also my the case for playing in the Reykjavik Open in Iceland in April. And that tournament too, I had a lot of like fun fights, and I'm very much motivated to keep playing, just with no pressure, no expectations, and still, tournaments like these where I'm playing classical chess and I have time to prepare for opponents, it motivates me to study chess and prepare seriously, especially in openings, and prepare for these very top level grandmaster players. And it brings a different level of satisfaction that I don't necessarily get from doing content. And I think it also can be a different form of content when I'll do these like game recap videos. So it's just a way to keep more variety and more balance.
I really appreciate hearing you say that, because I think that's, it's actually rare, but it's refreshing to hear, in that I don't think only at your level, Eric, I think that like a lot of the adult improvers who are listeners of this podcast, and myself included, when we go to tournaments, I mean, yes, it is, of course, to have fun too, but we are trying to improve our rating, trying to increase it. And I feel like almost regardless of someone's level, they go to tournaments, in part at least, to improve their rating and to get better. And it's just really interesting to hear that that's not really a top concern for you. You're there for other reasons and still able to really appreciate and enjoy the experience. And yeah, I wonder if maybe more people could follow that model sometimes, because I think it's easy to put a lot of stress on ourselves. So I appreciate that.
For sure. And I think there might be a lot of people listening to this podcast who have like never played an OTB event and only play online. And like, there's so much more to chess than just playing online and trying to raise your rating, but actually like going out in the world and finding top level events where people travel from all over who share the love for the game. It's super fun. And, yeah, I'm very much looking forward to this event in Abu Dhabi. It's going to be the strongest event I've ever played. Like, I'm going to be like 90 something seed. So, so it should be fun.
Yeah, that's great. I look forward to that. Look forward to seeing the recaps and such too.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll just finish with a couple of just, easy, fun questions, as I like to do when I close out interviews. Okay. So one of my questions is in regards to the I'm Not a GM tournament. You know, last year you unfortunately weren't able to take it all the way, but this year you did and you won the entire tournament. And that tournament is one of my favorite online tournaments in existence. I think it's great fun and I love seeing a lot of my favorite people compete. And this year you won the entire tournament. Congratulations on that, by the way.
Thank you.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was super
fun. What do you think was the difference in winning the tournament this year compared to last year? Do you think you're a more skilled player this year, or was there some other factor or factors that went into that victory?
Yeah, I definitely put a lot more work in this year compared to last year, just in terms of preparing for my opponents, even weeks ahead of time. Like when I knew I was going to be playing Levy, which I didn't actually have so much time to prepare because like the match was the kind of back-to-back matches. But I still prepared for him before I even knew I was going to play him. And there's a large amount of just work, especially when it comes to specific opening preparation, that can be done before the games. And against every opponent, I had a bunch of lines prepared, and I had to like download all their games and trying to scout out holes in their repertoire. And this is something that I'm most passionate about when it comes to just studying chess is preparing for opponents, whether it's for myself or helping someone else prepare for a specific opponent. So, it's something I just kind of do naturally without the need to discipline myself. And then I was also fortunate this year to have a bunch of people that I was able to train with before these matches. Like the day before I played Tanya Sachdev in our first match, a good friend of mine, Ray Robson, came over to my place, and we just played a bunch of blitz and we played out some of the openings that I thought that she would be likely to play. And then I did the same thing before the Levy match with another good friend of mine, Gauri Shankar, who also streams a lot on Twitch. And also have to shout out Lafong Hua and good friend Irene Sukundar, who also helped me train a bit for these matches. So part of the preparation was actually playing like serious training games against friends who weren't necessarily in the field, but... Actually, Irene was in the field, but once she was knocked out, we did a little bit of training together. And I think that was very helpful in just having someone to work with where you can kind of simulate the different openings that can come up and just be more prepared and more sharp.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting hearing that all that went into that. So that makes me even more impressed because, I mean, you know, you really prepared hard for that. And obviously it paid off. So congratulations again. It was an amazing victory.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Okay, so last question to close this out, and maybe it's a silly question, I don't know, but aside from the Stafford Gambit, what's your favorite uncommon opening to play?
Oh, yeah. I've been working on some offbeat openings in preparation for Abu Dhabi, which...
Okay.
When are you going to release this episode?
This will be released next week, so just several days after
okay.
this.
Okay, I can't leak anything too secret then.
Okay,
but there's a bunch of kind of go-to gambits I'll play that you can find a bunch of YouTube videos on. I'm a big fan of the Orthoschnapp gambit, which is a line against the French defense. Budapest gambit has been a favorite of mine for many years. It's where you play like knight f6 e5 against queen's pawn. England gambit, there's some fun traps I've made some fun videos about. So I mean, I guess for anyone who wants to see me play gambits, you can go to my YouTube channel and just type in the keyword gambit and you'll just find so much.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll do like a, you could do like a follow up tweet response to your episode announcement, like after your tournament, after that tournament's been played, and you can reveal which which of the gambits is your current favorite.
Sure.
Yeah. But that's great to hear for now. Lots of good stuff there. Yeah, I just want to say, Eric, thank you so much for your time today. It was a true pleasure having you on the show. And I know I've said this several times throughout the episode, so maybe this is redundant, but I just think you are a phenomenal role model for everyone in chess. I think you bring great character as a person to this game that everyone can learn from and emulate. And just thank you for all that you do for growing the game and bringing more people into it. We're all just so grateful to have you be a leader in the community.
Oh, thanks so much, Daniel. Yeah, I really appreciate it. And it was very much a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, my pleasure too. Thank you, Eric. Thanks for listening. This has been a production of my business, Adult Chess Academy. And that has a website with the same name if you want to look for it. You can also find me being way too active on Twitter by searching my username, Lona_chess. See you next week.